morning, Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry. Boy, well, finally getting our April showers here. We're going to have rain through the weekend. It started last night and off and on. The good news, both baseball teams are out of town, so I don't have to worry about rainouts. But,
well, there you go. Baseball-oriented weather, just what we needed. And we've got, I had clear skies last night when I was looking at the stars, so I knew today would be beautiful. And it is. It was nice and cool and crisp this morning, and
good.
The sun's coming out, and I anticipate a glorious day in Austin, Texas.
Well, I enjoyed my good weather yesterday and took advantage of it, realizing it's not here very long, and do it while you can.
Yeah,
so,
Okay.
So we've got sports on the agenda to start out with, and
all
these basketball and hockey are both in their playoffs, and the St. Louis Blues kind of piqued my interest because they're in the second round of their playoffs. They advanced to the second round, and it was kind of interesting because the Blackhawks, which were the favorites, ended up losing four straight, and the Blues ended up winning their first round. So I figured maybe this is the year that the Blues might succeed in the postseason.
Well, this is a good deal. It'd be great if they did. They're real come behind guys, like you say. The Cubs of hockey, and not only that, but there's a rich story behind this hockey team, and I think we need to hear it.
Yes, well, just to kind of set the stage for what's happening right now, the Stanley Cup playoffs take four rounds. So just like any other sport, it's become more difficult as we put more layers of playoffs on it. So it's a tough road, and calling them the Cubs of the NFL is not an understatement. They're the oldest franchise not to win the Stanley Cup. They haven't even been in the finals since 1970, and worst of all, they haven't even won a Stanley Cup final game. They're 0-12. So the Blues do have a history of being playoff duds. And what's interesting is in 49 seasons, it isn't like they don't reach the playoffs. In 49 seasons, they've made it 41 times. So the chances have been there. And perhaps the most frustrating season was 1999-2000, when they ended up having the best regular season record, but lost in the first round of playoffs. No other team has been so good in the regular season and stumbled so badly in postseason. So there's this kind of unique thing that they've got going on now. But the origin of the Blues is probably even more bizarre than their postseason ineptitude.
I agree.
Yes, if we go back to the mid-60s, the NHL consists of only six teams.
Okay.
They had the original six, the Canadiens, the Blackhawks, the Bruins, the Maple Leafs, the Detroit Red Wings, and the New York Rangers. And I think the owners were, money speaking, were kind of greedy and felt that we want to keep all this good hockey to ourselves. And so they were very resistant to expansion. However, TV plays a little piece in their expansion because they said, look, if you guys don't start increasing your geographic market and hit the West Coast, we're going to have to drop your TV contract, which wasn't extremely lucrative, but still one of the reasons. It's money. In addition to the fact that the thing that usually causes expansion in any sport is the threat of another league. The Western Hockey League, a minor league at that time, realized that since the NHL was not expanding to the West Coast, they had a chance to maybe become a major hockey league. So they threatened to become a league, and so put those two pieces together. And what you have is a league ripe for expansion. So the NHL decided to go very big with expansion, not one or two clubs, but they ended up having six franchises. Five of those franchises. So they had six franchises. So we're going to go from 6 to 12, and this is all happening to start the 1967-68 season. So they got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
In order to get this up.
They're doubling their operation, essentially.
Doubling it. And five of those franchises were awarded with what they call without qualification. However, the sixth one, St. Louis, was awarded a conditional franchise. The condition being, they needed to find an owner. Here we have a city that doesn't even make a pitch to become a part of the NHL.
Wow.
And we have them now in the middle of it. And so how does a team get awarded a franchise without even trying?
Right.
So what it does is it goes back to the Chicago Blackhawks. The owner of the Blackhawks insisted that St. Louis be given a franchise, and later he'd work out the details in order to find an owner. It seems that Mr. Wirtz was the owner of the St. Louis Arena. Mm-hmm. The arena, and as a landlord, he was anxious in keeping that profitable, but what he found out was that he was having trouble with finding tenants. It was in a state of disrepair, so he wanted to get rid of it. So his idea was, we'll put a franchise in St. Louis, we'll then have them be I will then sell that franchise, the St. Louis Arena, and I will be able to dump, at that time was kind of a dump, the arena. So they ended up, getting that, and the Solomon family, an insurance family, who had been a minority owner in the St. Louis Browns and the Hawks. They'd been kind of in
sports family.
In the insurance business. They were sports family, but they were clearly in the background. They were never on the forefront. So here they are, reluctantly taking on the chance to become the owners of the Blues, which. They did. And so what they did, the other thing that they did is they put all the expansion teams in one division.
That
meant that we had six expansion teams in one conference, six expansion and six original teams in the other.
Right.
Since the playoffs consisted of just one round with the Stanley Cup Finals, with the winners of the one conference playing the other conference, that guaranteed that an expansion team would be in the Stanley Cup Finals. Well, the St. Louis Blues were in the finals the first 3 years of their existence, but obviously were nowhere near as good as the original six, so they proceeded to be 0-12. So as you can see that there, some people actually consider that to be the glory days. The glory days are the first 3 years. That's it.
Wow.
But, as you take a look at the background, we'll talk a little bit about the arena as we finish this up, but just a little bit about the 49 years of St. Louis Blues history.
Yeah.
We find a team that's had some stars, Red Berenson, Brett Hall, son of Bobby Hall. They even had Wayne the Great Gretzky for a half a season.
Yeah, you're
kidding. Probably, if you blinked your eyes, you missed it. He came on in February.
When was that?
It was back actually in 2000, in the mid 2000s.
Oh,
okay. No, escape back in mid 90s, 1996. He came on board, and actually Wayne Gretzky's one of the lures was the fact that Wayne Gretzky's wife was from St. Louis.
That's right, so I dig his wife, by the way.
Yeah,
she's got freckles, and I like freckles.
Yes, I imagine you would. So the thing was that Gretzky was only there for a half a season. They felt that putting Gretzky on with Brett Hall, they would have two superstars that would lead them to the gold, to the Stanley Cups. It was unsuccessful. St. Louis was unable to sign him. They basically had him for a half a season. They were unable to sign him for a long-term contract.
Yeah.
So Wayne moved on to greener pastures, and that's part of it. So the futile efforts for postseason success obviously had a very unusual beginning. Unfortunately, last night the Blues lost in their first game of the second round, 4-3. So
that's close, at least.
It's close. They came back. They got a little momentum. They were losing by a couple goals, and they came back to come within one. So it's not over with, but you can never, I'd like to see them do something, but we'll just have to see how it plays out. Of course, both of us have fond memories. I didn't go to many hockey games, but I sure have memories of the St. Louis Arena, for a variety of things. Wrestling matches. The St. Louis Hawks didn't play there, but another team called the Spirit that was actually their announcer, their radio announcer was Bob Costas. That's where he got his start. He got his start in St. Louis.
I did not know that.
Yeah, announcing for the this uh, American Basketball Association team called the Spirit. So, you know, they had that go in. And the fact is, we know about the fact that the arena has had, you know, its name in the news because it, the roof was, came off during the 1959 St. Louis tornado. Not all of it, but a big part of it did with a TV tower beside it. And so,
We got to look at that driving to work. Is that it?
It was going back and forth. We could see that tower kind of, you know, kind of leveled off and then a big chunk of the roof open. So that kind of forced the need for them to do some repairs. And one of the things I found out that when they were doing those repairs for the arena, they actually did more, you know, more work inside. And they took down the fences or the wiring that was the last remnant of segregation in the arena. So although segregation in the arena had not been enforced through after the 1930s, there still was lingering that sign of segregation with this physical separation by means of a sort of a screen fence that they had up. St. Louis has got a reputation in terms of segregation. They were the Sportsman's Park was the last major league club to end segregation. And that was the 1940s. So that's how far it advanced in terms of St. Louis.
Well, yeah, we're from St. Louis, of course, and
yes,
as I got out in the world, and you did too, I'm sure you experienced the same thing I did, that the cultural winds seem to blow around St. Louis somehow. They don't quite get there.
it's a quirky state. It was a slave state, but it wasn't part of the Confederacy. It's kind of an in-between state, and it does have a sense of the Southern feel to it, particularly when we were kids.
Agreed.
You know that, and although it wasn't, you know, it was there. You could sense it.
Yep.
And this is just another sign. So it's amazing because I'll tell you, just to kind of put a finishing touch in terms of the whole thing. The Blues have had 8 different owners. They've actually, at one point, it looked like they really were going to lose the Blues, and God forbid St. Louis would lose another sports team. They lost 4 with the Browns, the Hawks, and the football twice. But Ralston Perina came to the rescue, and that's when we had that little era when the arena was actually called the Checker Dome.
That's right.
Now
it's coming back to me, and you know it's for people who've never seen it, and of course there's a lot of people who haven't in person, of course. But you can look at pictures now, and I remember it fondly. I thought it was a good looking arena. I know it didn't hold many people and all that kind of stuff. I thought it had a nice location from our point of view. Anyway, it was fairly easy to get to, and I believe. I went to one or two things there, one of which was a concert, and I think I watched a wrestling match there. I'm not absolutely positive.
You probably watched it with me, because I think Lou Thesz was wrestling Dick the Bruiser for the world championship of, you know, whatever region.
Oh, I would have definitely gone to that, because
they're
my two favorite wrestlers right there. Lou Thesz, you remember, Joe Garagiola was the announcer, and what he'd always say was, his big joke was, Lou Thesz had so much hair on his body, and of course was completely bald, as I recall, or close to it.
He was losing a lot of hair. Of course, here's a man in his 50s still wrestling, and he was a physical specimen.
Oh, he was great, but Garagiola would always say, well, if you want to win, just bring a match into the ring and light his hair on fire. Because he's forest fire, right? That was his big joke. But Lou Thesz was great. The Figure Four Grapevine? Come on.
Well, Figure Four Grapevine was Buddy Rogers.
Oh, no. Lou Thesz did it.
Did he do it too?
I'm pretty sure he did. I'm almost positive.
Lou Thesz had a lot of sophisticated moves. He was a scientific type guy.
Yeah.
Obviously, Dick the Bruiser was the bad guy.
Dick the Bruiser had no holds. That was the ironic part about that match, remember?
Yeah.
He had no hold whatsoever. He had no technique whatsoever, except to yell at the audience and to just do everything disgusting he could possibly think of.
He was like Mayhem Plus, no doubt.
Oh, he was great. He was great.
But I just point out that the reason that the arena was built in 1929 was torn down in 1999. And the fact is that it was built actually to do exhibits for the dairy industry. That's what kind of prompted its building. It seated about 14 to 15,000, and it was one level. It was not like double deck. So, and we kind of affectionately, or most St. Louisans, referred to it as the barn.
That's right.
It was a nickname that it kind of was coined. So,
yeah.
But, so
where it was built, the way it was built, and all the materials and stuff. Yeah,
a lot of wood. I mean,
it harkened back to another day. I remember when the roof was torn off, you could see the lattice work of beams, and it's all wood.
It was all wood. Not the whole thing, but the roof. Yeah. A lot of it was wood.
Oh yeah, the underpinnings of it and stuff like that. Anyways, good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Now we're gonna let's get some films, and I think our topic today is Chicago and the filmmaking industry and how it all happened. John, frame it for us, and then we're gonna talk about our favorite movies.
Yeah,
in Chicago.
In Chicago. Well, the thing is that as we take a look, when spring comes forth, we usually think of baseball, but also Chicago movie production. It seems like there's a lot of movies being made in the summertime, and I'm sure sometime in the next couple months I'll be on my bicycle and all of a sudden I'll run into a detour because I'm running right into a movie set.
Yep.
And in fact, back in the early 1990s, I ran through a set and crashed the set actually because they had to call cut when only The Lonely was being made with John Candy and Ally Sheedy. They were coming out of the Ambassador Hotel in one of their scenes when they had dinner there. The movie, and if they, hey, look, they're in my running route. What am I going to do?
Hey, that's their problem.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing is that Chicago has become a very, very big in terms of the film industry. It's right now, over the past 2 years, it's become a billion-dollar business here. And when we think about, you know, about that, that's in terms of the spending that's done on jobs that are created, the hotels spending, etc.
Yep.
And that rebirth actually starts back in the late 1970s with the filming of the Blues Brothers, and now is fueled with the filming of a lot of TV series. I mean, we can take a look back, you know, since the late 70s when the Blues Brothers was filmed to now, and we find that although there have been many blockbuster movies made, what's really carrying the industry right now in Chicago is a bunch of, as many as 8 or 9 TV series are being filmed here in recent years at a time.
Yeah, I had no idea when you told me
that. Chicago Fire is just you know, the tip of the iceberg. Two factors have really helped Chicago in this regard. One of them is the fact that they realized they needed to become competitive in terms of giving tax advantages to the movies. So they've started giving very liberal tax credits. And also what's happened is that they have taken some of the abandoned buildings, particularly a couple of buildings in the southwest side, about 20 blocks south of the Loop, southwest of the Loop, where the old Ryerson Steel Building is, and they got a big studio, a big studio that they can use. Build it out inside, and it's being used for a lot of those TV series. So the bottom line is that it used to be that if they were filming something in Chicago, they would basically come in for a couple of days of exteriors and then move back to Hollywood and finish up the Chicago, whatever it was. So there wasn't really that many days done, but there's a lot more time now spent. And the other thing is that the tax credits really worked in our favor because we were getting a lot of competition from Toronto as being sort of the knockoff Chicago.
Right.
So in fact, the movie Chicago, which is based upon the play, was filmed in Toronto, to give you an example.
I'm trying not to hear that. That offends me.
Yeah. So, but notice I used the word rebirth of the film industry.
Oh, that's right.
This isn't the first time that Chicago has had their heyday when it comes to movie making. And what many people don't realize is that Chicago was once the movie capital of the world before Hollywood.
Yep.
And so we go way back. I mean, you can go back to the actual invention of the film technology, which we're going back to good old Tom Edison, back in the 1889 or and thereabouts.
Right.
And so what happened is, as an inventor, Mr. Edison realized that invention was part of it, but even a more important part was getting patents down pretty quick. So he realized that it was important for him to get patents for his, whether it be, and his inventions in terms of the of movie making might start with the what they called at the time the kinetoscope, but actually there were obviously some peripheral things that he needed to do in order to basically bring the whole piece together. So what happens is that Edison forms a company called the Motion Picture Patents Company. This thing was formed in 1909, and what he did is he basically told studios, said, studios, if you want to use my process, you're going to have to pay for it. Well, a couple of the subsidiaries of his companies were big studios, and the biggest of which was called the S&A Studios. And so during about 1910 through 1920, most of the movie production in the United States was done in Chicago. Wow. But Chicago's part as a movie capital was not only in terms of the production, but they also, with this monopoly, created a distribution center that was, you know, the biggest. And at one time, Chicago had more movie theaters per capita in that period than any other city in the country.
What fueled that? I wonder. I'm curious. You don't know.
I don't know off the top of my head. I think that having the availability of information, you have to understand that even back in the early 1900s, things were fairly regional, and this will be demonstrated with the demise of what happened. So you have, you know, a second city that is, you know, has the market, and that basically fueled it. I do believe that's my best educated guess. But the problem that you would think, a couple of things. The high point of the movie dominance is back in 1915 when Charlie Chaplin and Gloria Swanson, as budding stars in the film industry, actually have films made in Chicago. A lot of times, when people realize that Chicago was the film capital back then in the teens, they alluded to Charlie Chaplin. Well, the problem, Charlie Chaplin's time in Chicago is a matter of weeks. He only made a couple movies here and was kind of disgusted with the weather. He's not the first one that has been that. And what's interesting is that there have been some other movies that were made at the time. One of them, the Great Bank Robbery, that movie was made in Fremont, California, which is a suburb of San Francisco area. Well, it was basically a part of this S&A Studios. They had a branch out there in California, and they made it. Well, Charlie decided, screw this weather, I'm going to go out to the branch and have my movies made, and that's what kind of made him go there. Now, as much as we'd like to think that, you know, the climate was a factor, the main thing, and of course that obviously is a part of it, but the breaking down of the monopoly and the fact that the companies felt if they could just, movie production companies, renegade pirate companies, felt if we could just get a little bit, get as far away from Chicago as possible. Uh-huh. So they ended up going out to the West Coast, and before you know it, Hollywood is it. Now, you know, we take a look at movie production from 1920 through 79 when the Blues Brothers made. There were virtually very few movies made, and
we know why.
Mayor Daley, actually, who became mayor, the original Mayor Daley in 1955. Was dead set about, he was very worried about having movies made in Chicago because he was afraid, because this is around the time that The Untouchables were being made.
He thought that
Chicago would gain the reputation of being a gangster, violent city. God forbid.
No. Yes. Look at today. Look what happened.
We still have our reputation. It's just, you know, that we have, rather than
different
having
characters.
Gangsters, yeah, rather than having gangsters and mobs, we have now have just gangs.
Yeah, we got rid of the stir.
Yeah, we got rid of the stir.
More efficient. It must be Twitter's influence. Everything's shorter.
Everything is shorter. So the thing is that as we take a look, there were a couple of movies. I'll just point out one that was made in the early 60s before we had our rebirth, and that was a movie called Mickey One, with Warren Beatty here, and there's some great scenes. It's kind of a surreal thing where he plays a comedian that's trying to get away from a crime element. And the thing is, his director was Arthur Penn. And
ooh,
so this teaming of Beatty, yeah, his teaming of Penn with Beatty would later come up in another movie, which you've probably heard of, called Bonnie and Clyde.
That's correct.
So a future years later, we had that. So, you know, we'll spend a little time looking at some of the other movies. I'm just going to kind of point out real quick some of the ones that we were kind of known for. The Fugitive with Harrison Ford has a lot of excellent scenes in Chicago.
Downtown, yeah.
Downtown, and it does have a way of getting out into some of the neighborhoods too, which is good.
Yes.
Public Enemies with Johnny Depp, Flame Dillinger. Which actually is great because they could actually go to the theater in which he was killed is still there, called the Biograph.
Wow. That is so cool.
Yeah, so I rode my bike around that for a while because that's right on Lincoln Avenue on my way to the ballpark.
But
that was a little detour I had to make.
Sure.
We've got, you know, some of the more recent, we got Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which is considered, I think, the most popular movie in terms of Chicago ones. We've got Dark Knight, the Batman movie with Heath Ledger.
That's right. Is another good one.
While You Were Sleeping, a Christmas movie with Sandra Bullock is another good one.
I think that's her breakout movie too, as I recall.
It is a very early in her career. It has some credible character actors: Jack Warden, Peter Boyle, Glennis Johns.
A lot of
good stuff.
I love
that
movie.
Just a couple more: The Hunter. With Steve McQueen, his last movie.
Oh.
Its claim to fame is the car on Marina Towers in the parking lot going into the Chicago River.
The round tower, the round.
The round buildings, the marina. Yeah, they're circular, twin 60-story circular apartment.
I don't know. I forgot to look it up. I think it's a Mustang that he drove off. I'm not positive.
I'm pretty sure it is. That's one of the more memorable scenes filmed in Chicago. And of course, we got The Untouchables was filmed here,
the only movie version.
Well, actually, there was an earlier one with Rod Steiger with Al Capone. You know, there is one with that features. Of course, this one features Al Capone, played by Robert De Niro.
Yeah, yeah.
So we
Rod
got
Steiger's
plenty of
great.
Movies, and
Rod Steiger's incredible. That was a good movie. I've forgotten all about that one. Yeah, so
why don't you give a couple
faves.
Of your favorites?
Yeah, yeah. My two favorites, and you know, the thing is that, you know how movies are, it depends upon what you're feeling, right? As to suddenly one day something's your favorite because you need it or you want to watch it or something like that. Ordinary People, that's been kind of an enduring favorite of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Strictly speaking, it wasn't filmed anywhere near downtown, but it was Lake Forest, and I think they did some shots in Evanston. And, you know,
Northern.
I really related to the suburbs. You and I grew up after we left the farm in Jefferson County and moved into St. Louis County. We lived in a suburb, you know, our high school and junior high years. So, yeah, I really related to it and everything like that. I actually had friends up in Lake Zurich, which is near there.
Right.
And so, yeah, I really felt it and identified with it. And it's an incredible movie. Tim Hutton's a first big role. He performed like a champ. I thought it was a really incredible. Judd Hirsch, I think it's his first big role outside of Taxi, the TV series, and everyone had their eyes on him, and he was incredible as the psychologist.
Right.
Yeah, and boy, knocked it out of the park. And Donald Sutherland, all great performances, incredible plot. Mary Tyler Moore, she certainly got nominated, didn't she?
She did. Robert Redford, it's his first movie director, directing a movie. But the thing about Mary Tyler Moore, who she stands out in the movie as far as I'm concerned, because she played so out of character.
Yes.
She was a badass mom in very subtle way, though. She just had a way of being the catalyst of the dysfunctionality of this family that was so subtle. And that's what led Tim Hutton to seeing a psychiatrist when his brother committed suicide.
Well, he didn't really commit suicide. He couldn't.
Oh,
they were out on a boat.
Out on a boat, yes.
Yeah.
But he had trouble dealing with it. And, of course, Mary Tyler Moore, being kind of the cold mother, get over it, move on, while the son just couldn't do it. So, that was a really good one.
Oh, yeah, and the father just couldn't see it. He just couldn't see it, you know, because, yeah. Again, she was so subtle. And heard a great interview with Mary Tyler Moore on Fresh Air. And it was an older interview, of course. And she, what she said what was so interesting, she said, I had no trouble with that whatsoever. All I had to do was pretend it was my family, because she grew up like that. Yeah, yeah.
Find me the functional family.
Well, yeah, that's a real task. my second, speaking of functional families, my second favorite is Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Oh,
very
Tom.
Good.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise.
Like that.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise did a decent
job. It's amazing. It's not even in my top 40, but clearly it should be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a feel-good movie in the sense that it's a coming-of-age kind of. Seniors in high school trying to get into a college, you know, they got a final project they've got to do, and of course the obvious choice is to run whores. Why not? You know, while his family's away, and he becomes kind of a pimp character. And it's hilarious. It's really good. He plays below his age. He's hitting below his weight there. And does a good job. You know, puts on a little weight, so he's got a little baby fat, and he's got that high voice, so he was all set for the part. He just walked right in and did it. Some excellent side characters in that movie, and of course some pivotal moments and scenes. His dancing in his underwear, of course, is a big deal, which he reprised in Saturday Night Live when he hosted. The other thing that was kind of cool, I thought anyway, was he has this huge party. It's like an all-nighter. He's hungover, and he had given up any hope that he would get into Princeton, which is what he was trying for.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I remember the scene where he puts on his sunglasses and smiles real big and says, "Looks like University of Illinois." So, you know, he's all set to go to Champaign-Urbana. And then he ends up, the guy, well, I'm not going to give away the plot. I should leave something for people to watch if they haven't seen it. But I think everyone's seen this. There's some great stuff in it. Super movie. What are your two, John?
Well, I just want to mention about the one you did, that there's a couple of very memorable scenes in Risky Business that kind of characterize Chicago. There's a scene on the elevator on the subway. And that's, I think there's also a scene where a car gets dumped into Lake Michigan near the...
Oh, yeah.
A
Porsche, something.
This movie has, even though the setting is in the Chicago suburbs, has got some very memorable scenes that deal with the city itself, so I thought that was pretty good. I've got two that kind of bubble under the top 40 here. One of them, and they're both, one of them's a pretty small movie called My Bodyguard that was filmed in 1980. And this movie, and I live in the Gold Coast, which is right across this one street over is the Ambassador East Hotel. The name's been changed, but it's the same
hotel. Which figures heavily into the movie.
That is where basically this kid lives, and what he does is his father, played by Martin Mull, is the manager of a hotel. So he's living in the hotel, and he's also living with his quirky grandmother, Ruth Gordon.
Oh, the best.
So we've got this kid who's kind of small for his age, going to a school, and he's going to a school that's, the setting is actually Lincoln Park High School, which is located 2000 North. I live 1300 North. A lot of the scenes and the whole thing evolves around the fact that he's getting pushed around by bullies that are led by Dylan. What's his name? Matt Dillon?
Matt Dillon, that's correct.
Matt Dillon, yeah, and he's one of his early movies.
Yeah,
so he's getting
he's
bullied.
Tormentor.
So what he decides to do is this kid decides, to hire a big guy to protect him. So he's my bodyguard. So I like the movie because I can relate to the scenes around. I live in the area. I just walk through practically every day where this film was made. It's a small movie called My Bodyguard, and I really recommend that one.
Oh, yeah. Two big thumbs up here, Mary Jane. I love that movie. We've watched it several times.
The other one is a movie filmed in 2000 called Return to Me, starring Minnie Driver, David, you're going to have to pronounce his name,
Duchovny,
and Carol O'Connor. This is the ultimate chick flick. This setting is unreal.
I didn't say that, ladies. I did not say that. He said
Excuse me, woman's movie. Okay. Yeah, I got to be careful here.
Yeah.
The thing is that return to me, what happens is that the Coveney's wife is killed in a car accident, and she leaves, you know, as a organ donor, she leaves parts of her, her heart is left to be given to in a transplant. Minnie Driver has a bad heart and she gets the transplant. She later then starts dating David Duchovny and realizes that she has the heart of his former wife.
Ooh.
This isn't science fiction, believe it or not.
No.
It's the real deal. The Carol O'Connor owns a restaurant bar in the movie that is actually the Twin Anchors, which is a famous, it's a well-known rib place here in Old Town, just north of where I live. It actually is the first place I took my wife on a date. Its ribs were considered so good back in the 80s at Sinatra when he come in, he had them. He says, and then after that he'd have shipped them Rancho Mirage. He liked them so much, and of course it's a well-known story. So Return to Me is pure. It's another movie film very close to where I live, and I could really relate to. So those are my two that I really like.
Very
so,
local to you. That's something.
Yeah. So I again look forward to this next year, this next summer, running into something, some movie made there. I know there are a couple of them that are being made. They're talking about no big blockbusters like Transformers or Dark Knight. Dark Knight is probably the one that received as much notoriety as any of them because of the way it just really showcased the downtown area in this kind of, you know, unreal way.
Yes.
And that's what attracts a lot of the people, the filmmakers, is the scenes.
It
and
has
the,
character.
The backgrounds.
The city has character, you know. And let's face it, a lot of those cities out west don't.
Yeah,
that's what they like about New York. That's what they like about Toronto. That's what they like about Chicago.
Right.
And you know, in the future, we're going to do a segment on Austin and the film industry, which is also has its history and, you know, some interesting characters involved in that as well.
Yes, so that's the movie side of our talk.
Okay, so yeah, we're on to fake news, and wow, every week we could say the same thing that couldn't believe what happened this week. We could just paste that in there. This could be cut and paste. The intro to this could be cut and paste, but we're gonna change it up a little bit. We're not gonna focus on our good friend President Trump, who is our president, and we're going to talk about the Democrats and what they're up to. You know, all this focus gets put on the Republicans, the Senate and the House, and the characters there, and it gets put on the White House, on Trump and Spicy, as we call him affectionately, and some other characters, you know, and Flynn, of course, these rascals. But what are the Democrats doing in response to all this? Well, so far, they have really not made the transition to a party with any kind of a message. And that's a real problem. All they are right now is they're the Republicans. They're what the Republicans used to be, the opposition party. They're just saying that, you know, how the Republicans used to always just chip away and fire away at Obama. They're doing the same thing, only now it's Trump. And Trump and Russia. And Trump and this and Trump and that. They got nothing. So
it's I'm amazed at the fact that I finally realized that you think of the Republicans as being the upper middle class, the high enders in terms of money, and then you realize that the Democrats basically over the last years or whatever
years,
30 years have actually accumulated their donor base based upon the high rollers,
the
Republicans have. They're the same.
They're somewhat different.
The bottom line is that they're financed by a lot of it by the high rollers. So they've basically disenfranchised, or they've kind of put the lower class or the populace that you kind of think of on the back burner. And
they lost the whole middle of the country in doing so.
Yeah.
And so it's been a huge disaster, and they haven't figured it out. This is hard. I mean, this is hard stuff. We're asking the Democrats to go cold turkey. That's what this is. And they're having trouble doing it. And the guy who's asking them to do it, really, at the head of this whole thing, is Bernie Sanders. And his influence can't be underestimated because and it's tricky because during the years when he was in the primary and running against Hillary Clinton, he got hardly any coverage. I mean, he just got minutes of coverage until that last bit. And at that time, he was filling stadiums with 27, 30,000 people, and it got zero camera. Zero. Only way you found out about it was on the internet, and they had great coverage. The Young Turks and a bunch of whole media companies grew up underneath Bernie, and because of that phenomenon, that there was such a huge hole. So, you know, that's going on. And so what Bernie did was kind of interesting is, everybody knows what his story is, but I'll just wrap it up real quick here, is that his whole thing is, take the finance out, take the donors out, and start working for the people. The reason you can't work for the people is because you have a conflict of interest. And as John, as you just said, yes, they have become another version. They've come Republicans Junior. You know,
yeah,
Republicans light or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah,
that's really what happened. Yeah, and you know they make noise to the contrary, and they're good at window dressing, and you know I have to say it's kind of despicable, but here comes Bernie Sanders who pulls no punches whatsoever. He's got a mission. He's got a punch list of items he's going to go over. There's only a half a dozen of them. He says them in a way that are really easy to understand, that really move people, and in truth, he has a lot of substance behind it. It could easily become policy, and he's an experienced executive. He was mayor of Burlington, a small town, but he did it in an interesting way by building coalitions, and he fought hard to get there. He lost twice. It took him 3 tries, and then wow. he had the same experience with House of Representatives. He finally got into the House. And then after a number of tries, he finally got into the Senate. He works hard. He builds coalitions. He's an independent. He does not have a party. So he's an interesting character, and he is a civil rights activist. You know, has been. He got jailed for it and up in Chicago. And so he's a New Yorker who moved to Vermont. Yeah. Interesting character, colorful accent, fun to listen to. And he's over the last 2 years, he's really become quite a public speaker. He can bring a crowd to their feet. And this has really caused great consternation in the Democratic Party. They are trying to use him now to build up their numbers and get their party built back up again. But it's complicated.
Well, one of the things I noticed about Bernie that's interesting is you point out he's able to go out, attract the crowds, do you know a lot of, on the road, incredible. I mean, when you look at it, what was Trump doing? He's doing the same thing. He's stopping you know the grassroots and stirring up stuff and doing the same thing. So basically it's amazing that now you know Bernie is basically just coincidentally doing the comparable thing, and obviously Trump was very successful, which kind of leads me to think, gee, I wonder what would have happened if Bernie would have ran against Trump.
Yeah, I wonder what would have happened if the primaries weren't rigged, and of course they were, and it's been proven now. And that's the biggest problem that the Democratic Party has right now, is they have to acknowledge that they're actually, we got a dumpster outside the window here. Bear with us.
I'm surprised I don't have one, because occasionally they're right on the alley right behind me here in Chicago, too.
Hey, it's color, local color.
So,
here's what's going on. You know, he really did win that primary. I mean, he had the numbers and everything like that, but there was a lot of dirty tricks and other stuff that happened that kept him from coming through and bringing home the bacon. And the party itself has never recovered from this. There's a core of people, and people call them the Bernie Bros. Turns out they're mostly women. They're not bros. Mm-hmm. And the whole Bernie Bro thing was a bunch of hired goons, by the way, who went online to try and smear Bernie by pretending to be Bernie, and they weren't. They were his followers. So anyway, that aside, a lot of heartbroken people who are still out there and they're still smarting from this. All they need, really, to come back into the Democratic Party is for someone of some standing in the party to say, you know what? We messed up. We were wrong. We backed the wrong horse. We should have listened, and we should have conducted ourselves with more integrity. Bernie was robbed. You know, somebody has to say some version of that. And once they do, things will that group will stop opposing everything. Of course, right now they are opposing everything. To ameliorate that effect, Tom Perez and Bernie Sanders, Perez is the elected DNC chairman, who that was also hotly contested. Keith Ellison was also running against him, and many people thought that he should have won that. But, you know, again, it's a little tilted. The DNC and the voting structure wasn't that different than the weird superdelegate situations in the primary for the Democrats. So they're just, they've got all this terrible stuff in their party. So anyway, they're dealing with this. So they said, let's heal it. Let's have a unity tour, I think they call it.
It's called the unity tour.
Yeah. So Bernie and the DNC chair, Tom Perez, go out on the road and they hit these towns, and they're aiming at red states and stuff too. So they're going around giving these talks, and I've watched about three of them, and they're incredible. They're really quite good. And Perez has grown into his role as Bernie's front man.
Yeah.
He does an introduction of Bernie Sanders that, you know, he could announce wrestling matches. I mean, he just goes over the top, and it's great. It's fun, and it's exciting. He stirs the crowd up, and he does a great job.
Sounds like a warm-up guy like Ed McMahon for Johnny Carson.
Wow. Only does it for about 10 minutes. I think the first one he did, he kind of missed his role, and he talked too long, and people were starting to shout for Bernie while he was talking. But he learned real quickly by the second and third ones. He made his part of it all about Bernie, just about. And so then they bring Bernie out, and wow, you know, Bernie does half of the whole thing. The other half is a smidgen of Tom Perez introducing him and all the locals getting a word in.
Good.
And so it's a good thing. It's a great thing. People do get fired up. And I think by the time, you know, the dust settles, I think what we're going to see is Bernie's going to have not his brand, his personal brand on the Democratic Party, because what he's trying to say is, hey, you don't need to do this because I think it's a good idea. You have to do this because the people think it's a good idea. And for some reason, nobody gets it. Nobody picks it up. You know, they're so worried about all this nonsense that they don't realize, you know, they're eating their own children. They're not doing the job. So we're going to see something happen here with the Democratic Party. And so far, it's been the tail wagging the dog. The activists have done everything good that's happened since Trump took office, not the Democrats. The Democrats have done their part. Yeah, they did their voting in the Senate and the House of Representatives. But it's really, really, really the activists who have given the moderate and even conservative Democrats a whole load of shit, and have been very effective, and then they've just doubled down on all the Republicans who are out of their minds. And it's been unbelievable. And, you know, you don't see all this stuff on TV too much, but just go on the internet. It's all over the place. And even if it's not on the network, it doesn't matter, because these poor reps and senators are really getting beat up. Feinstein got worked over real well. So, yeah,
I just like to point out, as you mentioned earlier, that when you take a look at this tour, it's about a 2 week thing that just recently ended. So but the other thing is that, as you pointed out, they're not stopping, you know, the Democratic areas. They're hitting the enemy territory.
Going to
Utah, Arizona, Nevada, Texas. You know, places where you know they're willing to, you know, hit the areas that they need to.
Bernie
recapture.
Has no fear. Yeah, Bernie
no
has
fear.
No fear. No, he really doesn't. And he did. He and Chris Hayes from MSNBC, they've done like two, maybe three town halls, right in the worst possible places that they could possibly go, and they invite people who voted for President Trump to come and talk about the issues with Bernie. And by the end of both of these, standing O's, the people actually loved him and they love his message. You know, it's a similar message in many respects to what Trump was saying, but not doing, of course, but saying. But the difference is that Bernie comes from a completely different place than Trump. Bernie, not many people know this, but you can look it up. He says he's a socialist. He is, in a sense, a socialist, but it's not a socialist that we know. It's a kind of socialist that was born in the shettles of Russia. Mm. It's called Yiddish socialism. And it came, it is, because in Russia the Jews spoke Yiddish, you know. So they came over to Brighton Beach and other parts of New York, and they brought that way of thinking and community. It's a community organization method, really, not so much as it is a formal economic system. And so that's what Bernie grew up with. That's what he was surrounded. And his dad and grandpa did it over in Russia. So this is like three generations of people doing this. So Bernie's almost on autopilot with some of these things. It's natural to him. And he does care about people, and he is self-effacing. And he doesn't comb his hair half the time, and he wears shitty suits, and he won't go to dinners with Trump and stuff like that. You know? He's great. He pickets during campaigns. He'll go out on a picket line. You know, the guy has got the stuff. He's absolutely genuine. So I don't know if they're going to find another guy like him, because, you know, that's a tough order. I'm not saying he's going to become president in 2020 or run for president in 2020, but I definitely think he's leaving his mark. He's redirecting the Democratic Party, independents, and even some Republicans back to their own self-interest, which is schools that don't cost a fortune, health care that is a right, not a privilege. And by the way, Medicare for All, that is going. That's happening. Like, that's it. That's gotten huge momentum in the last 72 hours, even. So that's on its way.
As the Republicans try to push through their repeal, huh?
Oh, crazy. Crazy. Never happened. I mean, the pressure is just tremendous, even on the Democrats. That's the Feinstein thing that went wrong for her. She would not commit to Medicare for All, and they just shouted her down. I mean, right in San Francisco, which is odd. She usually has a cakewalk on all these things. But the Democrats who are not going Medicare for All, they're going to get primaried or some damn thing. They're not going to have an easy walk. And, you know, people keep going. They keep thinking this is normal politics, and they keep going back to Bernie like a kingmaker or something. And Bernie's going, no. It doesn't matter what I think, you know. It doesn't matter who I endorse. This is not about me. You know, he keeps telling people they don't get it. So we just haven't seen that in politics in how long.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that, you know, it seems like politics now, you know, example Hillary, it's not so much doing the right thing. It's not doing the wrong thing. So in other words, I would call it defensive politics.
Oh yeah.
And Bernie obviously is not of that mold. The other thing that's kind of interesting about this tour is I was going to try to give, you know, I figured this would be an easy one to figure out, get my arms around exactly what venues they use, this or that. But this is so ground roots that they announce the tour, they say what states they're going to go to, and after the fact, you might find out they're in Mesa, Arizona, or Salt Lake City. They kept a very low profile in terms of, they went right to the roots. They weren't interested in broadcasting all over the world, you know, exactly where they were going and what. I was anticipating, you know, it'd be sort of like a rock tour that I would be able to go on the internet and say, well, here's a list of the places they're going, here are the venues they're using. And it didn't work out that way. It's not that kind of tour.
No, and they have a different purpose. And you know, I think it has. And Bernie's a smart guy, you know. And I don't know if he's thought about it or anything, but this is the old starter dough theory, is that you get a little bit of sourdough, and then you add it to regular dough that you're making, and it spreads, and soon you got sourdough, and you keep a little starter dough in a jar, and you keep doing that over and over. And so these little places are like starter dough. He's rebuilding this thing from the ground up, but he's not doing it himself. He's putting their nose in it, and that's what he's doing to Perez. And it's a smart move, real smart move. He got a lot of criticism from progressives for doing this, by the way.
Hanging his hat with Tom?
Just even, you know, same stage. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, but it's working. And now, you know, I think a lot of these progressive media people are trying to go, well, you know, maybe he does know what he's doing.
I think instinctively
he does. He's not like a mastermind. That's not his thing.
Well, I think that what's interesting about it, little I read about it, is that Bernie doesn't even profess to be a Democrat, and he's with a Democrat. You know, if somebody says, "I'm not," you know, he's "I'm not a Democrat."
Right.
But there he is with, you know, with the Democratic chairman. It kind of shows you that this guy is willing to. He's not going to pull any punches.
Not at all. There's great stuff. YouTube is the place to go, by the way, as we wrap up here. YouTube is the place to go if you want to see any of these tours. I would recommend just, you know, like, watch the second or third one once they got their act together. It's really pretty exciting, pretty good, fun to listen to. People have heard Bernie Sanders before. This is not the usual stump speech kind of stuff that he did during the primary or even after. This is new stuff. He's got a whole different approach to it. He's got a little theme. He did one of them called Fight Back, which is really quite excellent. Easy to follow, exciting. He's really brings up good arguments. It's the same material, kind of, but he goes at things from a different angle, and given the current climate, you know, it's needed. So anyway, I think we should put a pin in it, a fork in it, whatever. This puppy's done, brother.
Yeah, I think we've touched all the bases, and so as we wrap this all up, I want to wish you a good day, Jerry, and talk to you tomorrow.
All righty. Adios.